Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Verizon Hub, the home phone reinvented exclusively from Verizon Wireless.
Hello, everyone, and welcome again to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette. I'm an editor at HowStuffWorks.com, and sitting next to me, as always, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Guten Tag.
V. Gates.
Pretty good. Yeah, I've already extinguished. I could have said Ich verstehe nicht, wiederholen Sie bitte, which is pretty much the only other German I know.
Okay, then.
Which, unfortunately, will just have people speak to me in German more.
Yeah. Yeah, you never want to do that. Speaking of foreign languages and things that aren't what they seem.
Yes.
I think, weren't we going to talk about some clones?
We are going to talk about some clones, but we're not going to talk about cloning people or anything like that.
No, and nor are we going to talk about the Star Wars prequels.
Oh, please, the less said, the better.
No, we're talking about Macintosh clones.
I'm sorry, I'm still stuck on the prequels.
All right, do we need to give you a second?
I'm good.
All right.
So we're going to talk about Mac clones. And the reason why this is such a big deal in the first place is if you're a PC user, you might be wondering, okay, so what's the deal with the Mac? I mean, what's so important about it? What's so cool? Because PCs, they come in a variety of different flavors from a variety of different manufacturers, right?
Yeah. I mean, you could walk in your local, Gigantoid computer electronics store, assuming that it's still in business,
right,
and pick from 24 manufacturers,
yeah,
of different,
like, you know,
laptops,
HP,
and
Dell, Gateway. I mean, you've got all these Acer. You've got all these different companies that make these different PCs. They're all running, you know, usually Windows or Linux. I mean, mostly Windows,
right?
But they're coming from all these different manufacturers, and an HP may be less powerful than a Dell that's in the same price range or whatever. But when you start looking around at Macs, there's only one source for Macs.
That's true.
That's Apple.
Well, sort of.
Well,
only
sort
one
of
source.
Sort of, yeah. But
One official source.
One official source.
There we go.
Jobs would have it, Steve Jobs would have it, where there's only one source for Macs.
Yes.
And that would be Apple. So you wouldn't find a Dell computer running the Mac operating system.
No, well.
Not today.
Not usually.
Good Lord, Paulette.
You know, there is such a thing called a Hackintosh.
Yes, there is such a thing as a Hackintosh.
See, this is off topic, but I'll just point out that for you, those of you who are less Mac interested, I won't say Mac savvy, that's different. If you're not really interested in the Macs and you're going, what are you talking about? A Dell can run the Mac OS. It could, theoretically, but you kind of have to tinker with it a little bit, because now that Macs run on the Intel processor, if you have a Dell with an Intel processor and you want to violate lots of warranties,
end user license agreements.
Yeah. You could fiddle with it. And the thing is, the Mac OS is generally designed to work with the parts that Apple puts in the Macintosh. That's one of the reasons why it works so well, is because it says, okay, well, you're looking for A or B. It's like, oh, well, I found B. Well, there you go. You don't have to worry about whether or not you have an NVIDIA graphics card or an ATI or, you know, whomever else, because, right. You know, that's sort of what the Windows clones are all about.
So in order to run it on a PC, you have to create essentially what's called an emulator.
Yeah.
We've talked about emulators before when we were talking about multiple arcade machine emulators. So an emulator is just really, it's usually software, but it can be software and hardware working together that mimics the way another piece of hardware and or software works. It's not a copy. It's just trying to copy what that other piece of equipment does.
And people who do this generally have a varying level of success with it, depending on the kind of hardware and the age of the hardware that they're using.
And how familiar they are with it.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, that's different. I mean, we're talking clones, and that would be like you go into the store and buy an HP right out of the box that works with Windows. And it's going to work with Windows because that's, you know, it's authorized. It's a clone of the IBM PC from back in the day.
Right.
So, but Mac clones, well, that's a little different.
Yeah, but it wasn't. Let's take a little walk down memory lane. All right. Yeah, we're going to do that at the same time. That's just pathetic that we both thought of that. Yeah. So anyway, we're going to go all the way back to the Apple II days.
Yeah, that was when cloning was cool for Apple. They were happy with it.
Yeah, well, sometimes. the WAS was not so happy
with it. Yeah, let's say that.
They weren't.
There were official licensed cloners.
There were. But the first one I'm thinking of is the Franklin Ace clone.
Oh, wow. You did go back.
Yeah. I'm talking about way back to the Apple II.
Back
the
when Franklin, they made computers out of leaves and bark?
Yeah, well, you know, when dinosaurs ruled the computer world. So Franklin Ace, was a computer that came out of the Franklin Computer Corporation, and that was a clone of the Apple II. And it was not licensed. It was not authorized in any way, shape, or form by Apple.
Nope.
And it actually became the first success, it became the subject of the first successful attempt in a U.S. court of law to prove that computer software could be protected by copyright.
Wow.
Thank you, Joshua Coventry, who wrote a great article about this. but yeah, so way back, and this is back in, it was 1983 that ruling came down where they said, okay, you know what? An operating system can be, under copyright, can be protected under copyright. Which was a big, big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds, of course it sounds like it's common sense now, but this was back in the very early days of personal computing.
Yeah, they had to decide whether it was basically an original work. And, because even recordings were not covered by copyright forever and ever. You know, once the recording industry came online, if you will, the courts had to wrestle with that and try to figure out how to incorporate copyright law in for music. So Right. Every time there's some new technology like this and, you know, these authors are writing software, they're not writing a book. So they have to say, well, you know, does this protection extend? And they ultimately decided it did.
And so 1983, the court makes the ruling, and it's not until 1988 that Apple is able to force Franklin to withdraw its clones from the market. But that's the earliest example. But if you move forward a few years, you start to see licensed Apple software ending up on non-Apple computers.
That's true.
So you want to talk about this a little bit?
Well, I just know that when I was in junior high and high school, the Apple II was the dominant computer in education. So when my friends had computers at home, they had one of two machines. The Apple II, which was more popular in educational circles, or the Commodore 64, which was more popular with, I don't know, people who write today's video games, because they were the kind of computers that people were writing programs for. And an Apple II was considered, at least by my friends, something of a, you know, word processing machine or something that you played Oregon Trail on. So, you know, I first started seeing those machines back in the day. And I think the ones that I remember seeing were very similar to the Apple IIc.
Gotcha.
You know, and I don't remember much about that time because I was just getting my first Commodore Amiga at that point. And, you know, at that point, I'd kind of blown off the Apple II.
Okay, we can't go off on that.
I'm not going
Amiga
off on that
tangent.
I'm just saying.
All right. So let's pull it back. Let's skip ahead a few years. We're going to go all the way to the Mac years.
Actually, we don't have to go that far, to tell you the truth.
Well, not that far.
Because I remember the Halcyon clone days of the 90s, but as I started doing research, a site that I visit every so often called lowendmac.com.
Yeah.
They generally work with older Macintosh computers, hence the low end name. You know, this thing's 5 years old. What am I going to do with it now? Well, they have a lot of options for that. And they also had a bit of a history of the Mac cloning world. And one of the, and this is a good segue from our previous topic, because one of the very first cloners was a Brazilian company called Unitron.
Mm-hmm.
And they were licensed to make Apple II clones. In Brazil. That's because at the time, Brazilian law didn't allow the importation of computers. So they wanted to make Mac clones when the Mac came on the market in 1984. And around 1985, they basically talked to Apple, found out that Apple was going to want a 51% stake in the operation. Basically Unitron said, yeah, I don't think so.
Right.
So they essentially reverse engineered the thing.
Wow.
Hardware and software. They got a $10 million loan from the Brazilian government. And, unfortunately, Apple caught wind of their scheme. They actually got hold of a prototype that had a Mac ROM in it, a ROM chip in it.
Nice.
And as soon as they did that, they were able to prove, look, these guys are hacking off our stuff. We've got to stop this. This is our intellectual property. And basically they pressured the Brazilian government to make them stop.
Right.
Even though they already had a few hundred built. So they essentially sold their stake, all their plans to another company in Taiwan, backed out, and they still exist actually apparently today, but they're no longer in the Apple business by any means.
Right.
But that was in 1985.
So it
really goes back that far.
That's true. But if you think about it, Jobs, one of the things he was really famous for is that he wants lots of control.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
He demands the best possible product. He also is famous for supposedly knowing what the consumer wants, even if the consumer doesn't know. And that
he skates to where the puck is going to be.
Right, exactly. Yeah. He whatever it is that he offers you is what you want, whether you know it or not.
Yeah.
But Apple decided it didn't want Jobs around. And
new.
Jobs was kind of pushed aside for a while, and eventually he left the company to go found another company. We don't need to get into that because we did a whole podcast about Steve Jobs. But in the meantime, Apple made a decision. First of all, in 1991, they formed an alliance with IBM and Motorola. So then you've got Apple, IBM, and Motorola. They called the alliance AIM, A-I-M.
Really?
Yeah.
I just got a message on that.
Not wrong. That's AOL Instant Messenger. So anyway, they decided to create this new computing standard based on the PowerPC architecture. Skip ahead a few more years, okay? So they're working on this. This thing doesn't really – I mean, it doesn't take off the way they want it to. In 1994, the summer of that year, Apple starts to license the Mac operating system to other manufacturers, hardware manufacturers.
Yes.
And then things kind of fall apart for Apple a little bit.
Well, actually, it got a little crazy because when I started comparing timelines, not only were the authorized Mac cloners at work, other people were taking apart Apple machines and building new Macs, like
right.
the McMobile, which was a plexiglass portable Mac, and an Outbound laptop. Outbound was the name of the company. And these were all, you know, in the early to mid 80s, but they started to overlap into the late 80s. And that's right about the time that it started getting crunch time for Apple because they were starting to lose some money.
Yeah, Apple was really in bad shape, and they ended up purchasing the company that Jobs had founded. And we should go ahead and say that company, the Next Computing Company, that was not doing so well either. But they bought the company. Jobs was brought on sort of as a consultant. He ended up essentially taking over again, becoming the interim CEO and eventually the CEO of Apple. Mm-hmm. And so in September of 1997, the PowerPC processor gets introduced by Motorola. And then Apple says, you know what? We're done with this licensing thing. And they buy back the licenses.
Yeah. See, there were a handful of very popular clones from names like Daystar. Motorola had the StarMax. Of course, they were making the PowerPC chips, so it was certainly easy for them to get a hold of them. Power Computing, which had a very favorable opinion because they had all these, fight back ads that were just very popular at the time. And UMAX, who made the Super Mac. And the UMAX and Power Computing were sort of the last holdovers. They really pushed back against Apple saying, hey, look, we're building a business here. We're adding to your market share. What are you, crazy?
But Jobs was saying, you know what? This is not the way I envisioned computing. And if I can't do it my way, it's not going to get done at all. And so he was very much adamant on getting back all those licenses and really dictating what it means to, what a Mac product really means in the marketplace. He wanted to make sure that was his vision and not someone else's. And by his vision, we should go ahead and say, of course, that he's not necessarily the one who designed all the really pretty Mac features, but he certainly, is the one who champions them.
Well, he was the founder of Next. And Next Step was the operating system ran on those boxes. And that basically provides the underpinnings, or at least it did when they first came out with OS X or OS X, as right. It appears on boxes.
Or OSX, as I call it.
Right. So, it's not like they had him come back just so they could have him back. I mean, they actually got some very valuable technology out of it and essentially changed the way Macintosh computers operate completely. Once they incorporated those changes.
So let's skip ahead now, pretty much to present day, really to last year.
Now that they're gaining market share back and they have beautiful products that people like to spend money
lots
for.
Lots and lots and lots of money out for it. Yeah, so now you get to a point where Jobs has pretty much proven his worth to the company once again. I mean, he brought it from the brink of bankruptcy back to, I guess, its most profitable ever, really. And people are, more people were buying Macs. I think at one point it reached at about a 10% share in the market, which is pretty phenomenal, really, when you consider.
They were down below 5% at the time, at the low point.
So
that's a lot of computers. That's millions and millions of computers.
So now we're at a point where all the Macs are, again, coming only from Apple. All the authorized Macs are coming only from Apple. And now we have this other company that popped out of seemingly nowhere called PSYSTAR. PSYSTAR. This is a Florida-based company that claimed that what they were going to do was sell a low-price computer that was going to run the Mac OS X operating system. It was not going to be a Mac. You were not going to buy a Mac computer that was just marked down. It was going to be made out of off-the-shelf computer parts, but running the Mac OS. And again, this is one of those things where you have to make sure that your equipment is going to run this OS properly because it's designed for a very specific hardware setup. And
without the Apple ROMs, you're going to have sort of a limited experience with it.
You're definitely going to have to do some workarounds to be able to get the operating system to perform correctly. Mm-hmm. And one of the big drawbacks to the PSYSTAR approach is that they have said that they are not able to guarantee product support, that everything's going to work exactly the way it's supposed to. What they're guaranteeing is that you can buy a much cheaper computer running the Mac operating system than you would if you were to go to Apple directly. And, I mean, that might be true. And for a while, people were wondering if this was even a real company at all. I read a report from Charles Arthur from The Guardian, And he did some investigative reporting, and it was very interesting. He first was looking to see where this company was located and discovered that the address had changed while he was looking for it. The original address was apparently in the middle of this suburban area in Florida, and the second address was in a more industrial area. So there's that question. There's a question of, are there other entities behind SciStar that are really interested in just taking Apple down, taking the whole Mac computer down a few notches, and opening it up to make it a more open environment, because Apple is very famous for being a very closed environment. Mm-hmm. It's part of what makes them Apple. SciStar argues that Apple has created a monopoly because it's the only, they're the only ones who offer any equipment that can run the Mac OS, and therefore it's a monopoly on that operating system.
Right.
Apple, for its part, argues that it holds the copyright, and therefore anyone trying to put this software on an unauthorized computer is violating their copyright as well as their end user license agreement. But here's the thing. End user license agreements aren't law.
Well, depends on whom you ask.
Well, I guess we're going to find out.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, because they're not law right now.
It's funny because when I made that point about copyright earlier and how they have to make these decisions based on emerging material like this, this really is going to force the hand of judges, and I'm assuming plural because it's going to keep going. You know, as soon as one side loses, they're going to appeal. So this probably is going to go high up in the courts.
Yes, and it's not even scheduled to go to court until November 2009.
Yeah. For their part, I know that SciStar claims, hey, we bought the OS off the shelf. Therefore, we are allowed to use it. Apple doesn't seem to find that hold much water.
No, their end user license agreement specifically states that you can only use the Mac operating system on Apple hardware.
Well, there you go.
So, but the question is the end user license agreement, is that actually binding? I thought it would be interesting to kind of run down a comparison of the product that SciStar offers versus a basic iMac.
Oh, by all means.
So here we go. For $599.99, you can buy from SciStar the Open 3, which runs the Mac OS X Leopard version 10.5, has a 2.8 gigahertz dual core processor.
Right.
It's got 2 gigabytes of DDR2 800 memory. It's got a 500 gigabyte hard drive. It's got a DVD burner. It's got the GeForce 8400 graphics card. But you don't get a keyboard, you don't get a mouse, you don't get a monitor, there's no Bluetooth support, there's no FireWire support, and there's no wireless support. So those are things you do not get with that. Now, with an iMac, the iMac comes with a 2.66 gigahertz processor. It's not as powerful. It comes with 2 gigabytes of DDR3 RAM, so pretty comparable to the Open 3. 320 gigabyte hard drive, so not as much space. It's got a DVD burner, but it's not as fast as the other, DVD burner, the one in the Open 3. It's got a NVIDIA GeForce 9400 graphics processor, which technically is better than the other one, but it also comes with a mouse, keyboard. It has the 20-inch monitor because that's built into that's the iMac. And it has wireless and a webcam.
And now, it also comes with some software.
But
iLife package.
Right. That one costs $1,200, so
right.
It's twice as much.
Right.
So the question is, if you throw in the monitor, the keyboard, the mouse, a webcam, a wireless, card, things like that, how much more would the Open 3 be? It'd be a little bit more, and it still wouldn't be as expensive as the iMac. My question is it worth trying to save a couple $100? When you know you're not going to have the support that you would get from Apple, there's no guarantee that you will be able to keep that machine because there may be a recall in the future. I mean, does it make sense to buy one?
In my opinion, the answer to that is no.
Thank you for listening. No, I totally agree with you.
Because, I mean, okay, say you don't want to spend $1,200 for an iMac, but you do want an excellent, machine that's going to be reliable. Well, then buy a PC clone that comes from a reliable source, as an authorized copy of Windows on there. That way you can be assured that you're going to be okay. I mean, people who switch to Linux, There's some support, but it's not, you're not paying for support.
Right.
Of course, there's a very robust community that helps out with that sort of thing. But I mean, if that, you know, makes you a little squeamish, then, you know, you're probably going to opt for, in general, a Windows or a Mac computer. And, you know, then the options sort of drop away because you start going, well, you know, I just don't trust these guys. I don't really know much about them. And if Apple doesn't like them, if they're not authorized and they release an update that bricks my computer, that's not good.
And I think also that a great deal of the appeal of Mac comes in the form factor. Mm-hmm. I mean, Macs are gorgeous machines. There's no getting around it. They are beautifully designed. And I'm not so sure that that many people would be like, you know what? I just want that operating system. I don't care if it looks boxy.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it's a style, an aesthetic question, not just a, you know, performance question.
Well, otherwise, Vista and Windows 7 wouldn't look like they do. And the Ubuntu community wouldn't be working so hard on trying to improve the look and feel of its interface.
Well,
I mean,
and,
it's obviously plays a serious
and
part.
And it's not just the interface I'm talking about. I'm talking about the actual physical hardware.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you look at an iMac, it's a beautiful machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's just and the PowerBooks, everything, all of those look very nice. So,
that's part of why they can charge extra for them.
I'm thinking that SciStar may very well be an effort to bring down Mac and less of a viable business model, right?
So, like, so you're going the conspiracy theory route.
I'm not going to call it conspiracy. I'm not calling it a conspiracy.
But it is a theory.
But I would not be surprised to learn that the ultimate goal of SciStar is not to try and sell these computers, but rather to try and take down Apple's stance of keeping a closed system.
Sort of like the politicians who have no chance of Hades of getting elected, but they bring up considerably different issues just to get them out there, at least so they say.
Similar to that.
So basically they're not really there to make a buck. They're there to raise these issues and get these barriers broken down.
I would not be surprised to learn that. Now, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I would not be surprised to learn that.
I'm a fan more of the OS anyway, so it would be nice if it spread to more people, unless, of course, that means that more people write viruses for it, in which case, never mind. But you know, so I'm not exactly anti SciStar necessarily. I would like to see that they, you know, can work things out and maybe have some licensed clones again. I don't know that it would necessarily be a problem for Apple as much as Steve says.
Well, it depends. If Jobs is still there, I don't see it happening.
Well, no,
I just
don't think
I don't think it'll happen. But
we'll see.
I think that's a good discussion on Mac clones, which
right,
of
then.
Course brings us around to
oh no,
listener mail.
There we go.
This listener mail comes from Kimberly, who also made a request for an episode topic, but we're planning on tackling that in the future, so I'm just going to take the last little bit of her email. I really enjoyed the April Fool's podcast, especially when you mentioned ThinkGeek. The whole time you were talking about their mini product gags, I was wondering when you'd get to the soundtrack t-shirt. True to form, you guys did mention it. I've had my eye on that thing for a while, but being a poor college student, it's kind of on the back burner. Thank you again for all the informative podcasts, and I hope there will be many more in the future. Kimberly. Well, thanks, Kimberly. There definitely will be many more in the future. There's no way of getting around that. And I, too, want the ThinkGeek shirt. I asked for it I had that on my Christmas wish list, if you remember, way back when. That was on my stocking stuffer list.
Many podcasts ago.
Many, many podcasts ago. I have yet to receive that, probably because my wife has threatened everyone we know with bodily harm should I receive such a gift. There's no way I would not be able to enter a room without playing the music from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It's just, that's the way it is. And I'm talking everywhere. I'm talking work, too. So I would not be popular here either.
I would definitely need a laugh track.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that would at least get some laughs for your jokes. Zing! Instant rim shot.
Thank you very much.
Sad trombone. Thank you very much, Kimberly. If any of you would like to write us, you can do so at techstuff@howstuffworks.com. And remember, you can go to our website, read all up about different technical issues and interesting articles. That's at howstuffworks.com. If you look to the right, you'll even see links to our blogs, where Chris and I blog every single workday.
Blog, blog, blog.
Sometimes more than once if we get really antsy.
It's true.
So check it out. Take a look. Let us know what you think. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables. Ooh, yum. And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notified, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.